All right. You just got back from a trip.
I did. I had so much fun, and I posted all the pictures of the women's history stuff I found, as usual. So it was a blast dragging my family around, which really, because San Antonio is so compact, it was like all right next to each other.
That's so nice.
But the love for Selena Quintanilla in that town is over the top.
Really?
Like, in the best possible way.
Yeah.
There were like little girls dressed up like her, taking pictures on her bridge, and there were like t-shirts that just said the queen Spanish, and like pictures of her. It was just like really nice to see, you know, a death that's like 30 years ago still being like, she was so well loved.
Yeah. I love all the videos of the little girls who dress up as Selena and they hit pinatas of what's her face that killed her.
Yeah.
I can never remember her name, but you know, that's not important.
Good.
Good. We shouldn't remember her name.
Get out of here.
But we've already talked about Selena, so we're not here to talk about her tonight.
No.
We're here to talk about history.
On the Rocks!
With Katie.
And Allie.
This is a podcast where we talk about famous women in history.
We talk about good women and bad women, and fictional women and non-fictional women from all times and places, because women have nuance.
But keep in mind, we're drinking the entire time.
And we are not historians.
No.
And we're technically, I know we already did our spring break, but now we're on actual school spring break, because Easter was so late this year.
I thought it was early this year. It was late last year.
No, Easter is super late.
Really?
This is the second latest it can be.
I think, don't know why in my head I was like, this is like the earliest it can be, because I thought it was so late last year.
No, maybe it's been really on like Jake's birthday before.
Really?
It's been in March.
Wow.
Yeah. But anyway, we're not doing any mini-sode or anything crazy tonight. We're just pushing on with season 20 because we've taken our spring break already.
Yep. Exactly. Are you
busy? I'm so busy. I shouldn't be doing this right now. I have to be the Easter bunny. That's what you're doing, though.
That's what you're also doing. You're hiding eggs all over your yard. You're getting your Easter baskets ready. So we know that you can't stop and look up what these women look like. So we're going to get a little
physical,
where we describe what they look like. I forgot about that part.
Yeah.
All right. Allie, who are you doing and what does she look like?
I am doing Sarah Bartman. Unfortunately, this is a very difficult physical to do because Sarah was a South African woman of Khoikhoi descent, and her body was exploited throughout her very, very short life. She was a voluptuous black woman with what is known as steroistopecia, which is a body type that's really uncommon in Western Europe and is categorized by a large buttocks that has a buildup of fat over top of her glutes. Paintings and drawings of her show her wearing skin-tight flesh-color bodysuits or partially nude, and she's adorned with beads and feathers and often like smoking a pipe in the drawing or the picture. So that is what Sarah Bartman looked like, but all the pictures you're gonna find are really exploitative, so I would say just go off of my description and don't even give the internet the light of day to look it up.
Well, I am doing Daisy Duke. Daisy is a lean, athletic woman with brown wavy hair, an oval face with wide-set almond-shaped eyes. She has full lips and a wide southern smile. But of course, she is most known for what she wears, which is typically a small shirt, maybe a button-down tied in front, and cut-off denim shorts that show off her literal million-dollar legs. And that's what she looks like, which is so funny because I feel like our generation thinks of her as blonde because of Jessica Simpson, but every other iteration is brunette.
Brunette, yeah. During the original Dukes of Hazzard.
Yep. So she was played by Catherine Bach. Mm-hmm. So that is Catherine Bach's physical description.
Yay.
Not Jessica Simpson. All right. Well, do you want to know what you're drinking?
Yeah, I really do. I've already started drinking it because
perfect.
I'm thirsty. So tell me what it is.
So this is called Who Wears Short Shorts? And it is Southern Comfort iced tea, fresh lemon juice, blackberry brandy, and fresh rosemary. You shake it all together and then garnish it with more rosemary. And that's it.
It is so delicious.
Oh, that is good. I like that.
Yeah. It's very, very, very refreshing.
Yes, which is good for today.
And I already, just based on our physical and how so much is based on their bodies, like, what a good comparison. And again, okay. What an accident.
It is, because I was supposed to do Daisy Duke the week after, and I don't even know if Sarah Bartman was on our list this
season. She wasn't. Yeah. I just was like, I knew I needed a shorter story because I'd be doing all my research on the airplane. So I like printed out pages and like pre-downloaded articles and videos and stuff. But
yeah, we like did not plan this at all. We just picked two short stories.
What an amazing comparison. Wow. Good for us. Okay. Yay. You want to know what I know?
Yes. What do you know about Daisy Duke?
Okay. Daisy Duke is the name of the sister of, I believe the name of the sister of the Duke brothers in the Dukes of Hazzard, which I never saw the Jessica Simpson movie. And I don't even, it was a show, mm-hmm. I think. And I never really watched the show. I get the premise. Mm-hmm. Of the show, I guess. But Daisy Dukes have now be, her name has become synonymous with very, very short jean cutoff shorts.
Yes.
So like the name of the character has now become an article of clothing.
Yes.
So that is absolutely what I know about Daisy Duke.
So I got most of my information from Wikipedia and Wiki fandom. Really like the characters, not that deep, but you know, I think it's still fun, and I think she is important to pop culture history. So
and women, I mean, still my daughters will call short shorts, yeah, Daisy Dukes.
Isn't that so
they don't
funny.
Know why.
No.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's get into why. She drives like Richard Petty, shoots like Annie Oakley, and knows the words to all of Dolly Parton's songs. This quote from the episode One Arm Bandits perfectly describes the female lead of the Dukes of Hazzard, Miss Daisy May Duke. We don't have an exact birthday for Daisy, but the show takes place from 1979 to 1985 in the fictional Hazzard County, Georgia. The show obviously focuses on the Duke family. You have the Duke boys, Beau and Luke, and their cousin Daisy. So they're cousins, not siblings.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. And everyone's Uncle Jesse. So no parents to be found, from what I could understand. The Duke boys race around in their customized 1969 Dodge Charger stock car, dubbed the General Lee, evading crooked and corrupt County Commissioner Boss Hogg and his bumbling and corrupt Sheriff Roscoe P. Coltrane, along with his deputies. They always manage to get caught in the middle of various local escapades and incidents. Now, according to the 1997 reunion movie, Daisy's mother died during childbirth and her father died in a car accident when she was 6 years old. So she came to the Duke family farm to live with her Uncle Jesse and was essentially raised by him. Daisy was a rambunctious but intelligent kid participating in the all-school spelling bee, which she would have won, but she was cheated by Dewey Hogg.
Oh,
the Hogg family are the worst.
Dewey. Got you again.
Daisy was a cheerleader and a prom queen, and she had dreams of being a singer or a writer, maybe a model or a journalist. She had lots of big dreams. But those dreams got derailed when she got roped into working at Boar's Nest as a server. This is the local bar owned by the crooked commissioner, Boss Hogg. She ended up with this job because she was trying to help her family out. So around the time that Beau was graduating high school and Luke was getting out of the U.S. Marine Corps in 1976, the Dukes needed a loan. Since Boss was president of the Hazzard County Bank, they went to him for help. He agreed to give them the loan at 30% with the Duke farm as collateral. And as Jesse was trying to negotiate with Boss, Daisy stepped in and asked him, if I agree to work for you at the bar, would you consider giving him the loan at 15% instead of 30%? So apparently he had been after her to work there for a while because she looks good in there.
Oh, yeah.
Boss agreed to the conditions because he said, you may be a Duke, but you sure do have the prettiest legs in all of Georgia. But this ends up benefiting the family because Daisy is now present for all the dark shenanigans that take place at the Boar's Nest. And she's able to eavesdrop on Boss and the sheriff's crooked conversations. She does get fired a few times throughout the series, but always manages to slip back in. Now, Daisy is a twist on the classic Southern Belle. She's very polite, friendly, and of course, loyal to the Duke family. But that all can turn into feisty really quick, and she can absolutely hold her own when the chips are down. Daisy also has plenty of skills that help the boys out. She is an excellent driver. She was even offered a contract to be a race car driver after winning 2 NASCAR level races. She is also good at horse riding, sharpshooting, archery, mechanics, brawling, motorcycle riding, and tons of other stuff. She gets on the CB radio every once in a while under the handle Bo Peep. In one episode, she successfully rebuilds a carburetor in 49 seconds, mostly in the dark. And after the crew steals an armored personnel carrier, she is able to accurately fire its main gun while the vehicle is in motion with barely any instruction from her veteran cousin. And for that last feat, Uncle Jesse proudly declared her Sharpshooter of the Week. And of course, she routinely has to hold her own at the bar because she is constantly being sexually harassed.
Honestly, poor Daisy.
Constantly.
This is like the Betty Boop situation when exactly. She was a bartender.
Obviously, cars are a big part of the show, and she has some pretty iconic cars throughout the series. The first was a yellow 1973 Plymouth Roadrunner with a black stripe along the sides and up over the roof. Then she had a Plymouth Satellite until Bo and Luke sent it off a cliff after the brakes failed. And after that, she received her iconic white 1980 Jeep CG7 Golden Eagle named Dixie. It had a golden
Eagle. So they have a Robert E. Lee car and
a Dixie car.
Wow, mm-hmm. Their family is not politically appropriate.
It had a Golden Eagle emblem on the hood and the name Dixie on both sides. Despite being a badass and the most sought-after girl in Hazard County, Daisy never seemed to find a long-lasting romantic partner. Deputy Enos Strait has a long-running crush on her, literally for the entire run of the show, but he's just not quite her type, because it seems like her type might be more on the bad boy side. She almost married Boss Hogg's nephew, Jamie Lee, but then finds out he's a villain right before the wedding, so thankfully that doesn't go through. Then she falls for an English duke, but then finds out he's a con man.
It's kind of rough go at it.
Really rough go. Later on, for the 1997 reunion movie, they say that Daisy did get married, then got divorced, almost married Enos, and then backed out. So she may not have found love on the show, but apparently she does end up getting out of Hazard and getting a doctorate in ecology at Duke University, which is very cool. So the character of Daisy was apparently inspired by a real woman, a guy named Jerry Rushing's cousin Delaney, and she was actually the hardest person to cast because they wanted someone beautiful, but also someone you could believe was a real hard-working race car driving gal. And they ended up landing on Catherine Bach, even though that's not who they were looking for initially. And thank God they did, because she'd be really instrumental in designing the character. So the producers put out that they were looking for a Dolly Parton type, and Catherine being more athletic and brunette didn't think she had a chance, but she was hired on the spot. So she gets the job, and she's talking with producers, and they bring her their costume ideas. And they're like, we're thinking that she wears a tight white turtleneck, go-go boots, and a poodle skirt.
Nope. Why? In this show?
Absolutely insane.
Mayhem.
Catherine was like, I have a different idea. Is it okay if I bring my own outfit? And they're like, yeah, absolutely. So she brought a homemade t-shirt, high heels, and a pair of cut-off denim shorts. They loved it. And Catherine would end up making a lot of her early costumes, including the famous red bikini. She made that.
Wow.
Her look would become iconic, but especially the shorts, which would soon simply be called Daisy Dukes. The network censors were understandably a little nervous about these shorts. They were worried that they would be too revealing, so they came up with a compromise. She would wear flesh-colored tights or pantyhose to ensure that they didn't reveal any more than they should. So every episode, she's actually wearing pantyhose under the shorts.
Cover them legs up, yes. Girl.
After her character and, you know, her looks proved to be so popular, Catherine posed for a Daisy Duke poster, which ended up selling 5 million copies. One copy even ended up in the White House. Catherine had visited the White House and given a copy to one of her former school teachers, a woman named Shirley Moore, which I love the idea of this, like this little old lady working in the White House, and she gets one of the original Daisy Duke posters.
That's what you really want as a teacher.
Yes.
Honestly. A sexy picture of my successful student.
It was quickly a hit at the White House, obviously, with everyone asking her where she got it. And if they could get one. But a lot of people were surprised when Nancy Reagan was a fan. The quote from the 1981 article, which I did like see like a PDF of the microfiche. This is a quote that is from the teacher writing to Catherine. And she says, "I'm the envy of the White House and I'm having your lovely poster framed. Mrs. Reagan saw the picture and fell in love with it." Which I think is so cute. Of course, the shorts showed off her long legs. And during the filming of the show, Catherine's legs were insured for $1 million. Pretty wild. I wonder if she was one of the first people to like
insure a body part.
Because I always hear about it with like Jennifer Lopez's butt and like some other people have insured body parts. I can't remember. But yeah, like that's got to be one of the earlier times it's been done, right?
Yeah, it has to be. And like, I do get it. You know, I'm sure like if people like Julie Andrews had maybe like insured her vocal cords, then I mean, I know she already got a payout for that accident. But like, think about like if it's your moneymaker and you're like a violinist.
Yeah.
And you have to go to surgery. Why not get your hands insured?
Yeah, 100%. So two other women have donned the famous denim shorts. In 2005, Jessica Simpson was cast as Daisy. People generally liked her performance, but it was also understood that she was cast more for her celebrity than her similarity to Catherine Bach's original portrayal. Her costume was altered to make it more sexual. The shorts were even shorter and the tops were even lower, revealing much more cleavage. There were also no pantyhose under the shorts, so bare legs.
Fully bare.
Yeah. The biggest difference, of course, though, was her blonde hair. I guess they were back to the Dolly Parton type that they were looking for initially. The movie also was famously accompanied by a Jessica Simpson version of "These Boots Are Made for Walking." I did not enjoy her version.
I didn't either.
Do you think that Jessica Simpson's a good singer?
I think she's a fine singer.
Yeah.
I think
she muddles through.
Yeah.
Like she's like,
I don't think she's excellent.
No.
You know, she's not like Ariana Grande is like a powerhouse.
Yes.
And viewed as kind of like a ditzy celebrity. Mm. I think like Jessica Simpson was kind of viewed as like a ditzy pop star celebrity and was a fine singer.
Yeah.
You know,
every.
But I'm sure her pipes are good. Whatever it is, it's like it's hard to do that. Mm-hmm. Like I think about like I know like average singers in my day to day life and they couldn't perform like that every day on tour. So even if she's an average famous singer, she's still better than everybody else around her. You know, I don't know. It's hard.
One of my favorite things to come across my Instagram feed every winter is the Jessica Simpson Ozzy Osbourne Christmas. Mm. It's like walking in a winter wonderland and they do a duet of it and it's so crazy.
So the late night, this came out in 98, right? This Dukes of Hazzard.
The Dukes of Hazzard movie came out in 2005.
Okay, 2005. I don't know. I feel like everybody from her era was doing movies and maybe she felt like she needed to do that. Like she was in a celebrity show of what was those called? Reality show.
Yeah, she had a reality show. And then she was also in the movie with Dane Cook, Employee of the Month.
Yeah. And I mean, like Mandy Moore's celebrity was very quickly transforming to movie and voiceover. Like the Spice Girls did it. Britney Spears did it. Like,
it's actually fun. I always imagine Jessica Simpson as an actress first and then transferred to. I don't know why that was in my head.
No way. She was a singer first.
Wow.
For sure.
That's wild.
She had songs out when I was in middle school.
Wow.
So in the late 90s.
Hmm. I guess I never really thought that deeply about her.
Yeah.
Until right now.
I think about her often. Jessica and her tuna, Chicken of the Sea.
So that was that movie. Then in 2007 for the film Dukes of Hazzard, The Beginning, this is kind of a prequel movie, she is portrayed by April Scott. Since the show and the movies, more discussions have been popping up about the Dukes of Hazzard franchise. There is a lot of Southern pride in this show, which is famously represented with the car named after Robert E. Lee. And the car has a giant Confederate flag on it. So obviously this is like not the best. We don't love this.
It's super problematic now.
Yes. And so for years, people kind of wrestled with like, what do we do about this? And, you know, TV Land at the time had the, like, they're the most recent people to have the rights to it because like that's what they do. They play old classic shows like this. And they're like, no, it's fine. It's just like that's it was okay back then. Like, you know, we didn't have the same sensibilities. But then in 2015, the Charleston Church Massacre happens, and TV Land was like, oh, like, I don't know what, like, it was just like, this was their end. They were like, okay, we understand. Like, we don't want to be associated with this at all anymore. Like, this is a symbol of hate, you know, like, for so many people, it is just too painful of a symbol. So TV Land ended up stopped airing the show. And I think they still have the rights. So, like, there's no real way, unless you have, like, DVDs of it, to watch The Dukes of Hazzard. And, you know, I understand, like, it's a fun show about, like, boys having a good time. But also, like, it's really hard to ignore the giant hate symbol in the middle of the show. That's, like, a critical part of every single episode.
Right. It's like, you know, it would be like trying to air Dirty Dancing with the plot not being about abortion.
Yeah.
You can't do it. So, like, there is this thing, and I'm mm-hmm. not relating the Confederate flag to abortion. I'm just saying it's a movie that people struggle with because yeah. people who are anti-abortion are like, well, why are we showing this movie? Right. Mm-hmm. When it's like, you know, obviously what's going on here is like, it can't be, it's too interwoven into the show to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Without changing the show entirely. So it's either you right. keep the show or you don't keep the show.
Yeah. And thankfully, in the other versions of, like, the 2005 and the 2007 movie, they actually did take, they, like, and this is way before people were really talking about, maybe not before people were talking about it, but before TV Land decided to remove the show, but they were like, we're not doing the Confederate flag. I'm sure it appeared in the movies, but they're like, we're not putting it on, like, the car, which is basically one of the main characters.
It's like in every show. Scene.
Every single scene. Flying through the air. So, yeah, I don't know if you can watch the show anywhere now, but obviously it has had a lasting impact on our culture. And Daisy herself was a huge part of that. Not only is she a fashion icon, but she was also a girl who was down for some mayhem. She had to be rescued a few times, and sometimes she was, you know, portrayed as being a little naive. But for the most part, she was seen as a part of the gang. She didn't sit still and wait for the boys to come home or, you know, shame them for doing bad things. Maybe she did sometimes. But, you know, she's in the armored vehicle manning the artillery. You know, she didn't ask her cousins to beat up guys who were treating her poorly. She handled them herself. And I just, it kind of reminds me of, so Dee, the character in It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. played by Caitlin Olsen. When Caitlin Olsen was auditioning, she was like, I don't want this character to just be like the girl that's nagging on all the boys. She's like, I don't want to play that girl. And they're like, oh, no. Like, you're a terrible person in this show. Like, they're like, you're a part of it all.
Yeah, you're like, I feel like with Daisy Duke and also with Always Sunny, it's like the female character is not a passive bystander.
Yes.
Like, they're mm-hmm. an active member of, like, the shenanigans that is happening
100%
in the show.
And I kind of love that. So one of my favorite things that has come about in, like, recent TV shows like 30 Rock mm. is that the two, like, the main male and female characters, there's no sexual tension there. Mm-hmm. I love that. I love that they're family. It's not like, oh, like, the boys are fighting over Daisy again. It's like, no, yeah. she's their cousin. Like, mm-hmm. they're all just hanging out and, like, they love each other, but in this very platonic way.
It's also true of Ted Lasso. I yes. felt like when they did not pursue the Ted and Rebecca thing, I was so happy. I was like, thank you. The two main characters can have a collegial
yes.
relationship without falling in love with each other, because that is most of our freaking lives.
Yes, 100%. And I love that, like, this is an early show doing that mm-hmm. with a really attractive woman. She's not like
right.
who is the woman in Mayberry, like, aunt
yeah
somebody
yeah
you know, she's not like a dowdy old woman.
Yeah, you know what she always reminds me of, Daisy Duke's Catherine Bach. I always thought her outfits reminded me specifically the, like, plaid button downs that mm-hmm. are tied up of Marianne from Gilligan's mm-hmm. Island. Mm-hmm. I always in my head put their outfit sense together. I know Daisy Duke was a little bit more rugged. She mm-hmm. would do, like, t-shirts and stuff that mm-hmm. were cut up, but in my head I think of them as the same, with these very short shorts and mm-hmm. this cute tied up shirt and, like, the brown hair. Because mm-hmm. of course, as a kid, that was growing up in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Blonde hair was the
everywhere.
Yeah, it was the end game for everybody. It was like, you're going to end up blonde if you right. want to be cute. Mm-hmm. And like, obviously things have shifted in different 90s were weird.
They were yeah.
so weird.
You know, it's so funny. I said something to one of the girls last night at the baseball game. I mentioned your comment about like, yeah, if you just floss and do squats at the same time, you're not wasting time. And I was like, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. And she was like, was she a teenager in the early 2000s? And I was like, yeah. Yes. And she goes, so are my sisters. She goes, they don't watch TV if they're not doing crunches.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, nail on the head. Amazing.
We have been targeted. We've been targeted by media.
We blame you, Cosmo Magazine.
Making us think if we're relaxing while not working out, you are gonna, like, you're wasting your time. Your husband's gonna leave you, cheat on you, you're not pretty enough.
With Daisy Duke.
The blonde version.
To make it even worse. But anyways, Catherine Bach's portrayal of Daisy Duke proved that girls can be beautiful, tough, scrappy, friends with boys, good-hearted, and sometimes up to no good.
Aww.
And we love her for it.
Yay, Daisy.
All right, well, let's get another drink and get into a different story.
Let's do it.
We're back.
Part two. Not as fun of a story.
Oh, no.
Definitely depressing, dark, dreary. Yes. Do you want to know what you're drinking?
Yes.
So this is called What's Mine is Mine.
Okay.
And it is rum, honey, simple syrup, and some like soda water poured over top of it after it's shaken over ice, and some rosemary.
I love it. Cheers.
Cheers.
Mm. Oh, that's so good.
Yeah, I really needed some rum today.
Yeah,
I felt like,
agreed.
We don't use
that.
Enough of it.
No, we don't. I've been trying to use it more.
Me too.
And I love it so much because it just goes with everything.
It really does. It tastes good with a lot of different mixers. Mm-hmm. I think that's the thing that's really beneficial about it. Like, it's great with different like fruits and flavors like coconut and citruses and whatever. So it's great. What do you know about Sarah Bartman?
I know that she was treated as a side act. I know that she's just kind of mistreated. And I don't really know the details of it, but I think that also it's like it just led to a lot of like negative stereotypes, unfortunately, like what they did to her. But again, I feel like she's been mentioned before in other episodes. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't really know her story. So,
yeah, her story was hard to go through and hard to find because everybody like kept being like, we think we know this, but we don't quite know this because there's just like a lot of speculation around what was happening. So that's kind of my caveat at the beginning for there's a lot of information out there about Sarah Bartman, but I read a lot of different things and watched a lot of different videos and documentaries, and they were all had different information.
Yeah.
So I tried to like summarize the story as best as I could with the information that was all the same.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a lot of this from The Tragic Life of Hottentot Venus, Sarah Bartman, The Tragic Exploitation of an African Woman, and then obviously Wikipedia and a variety of articles online. There were some by the New York Times just about exploitation of women. And then there's a lot of like body image, like articles online and body images strife with controversy, as we were talking about in the first half of this episode. But also Black women's medical history has so much controversy. Mm-hmm. So like, forgive my partial ignorance if I say or like, do something that I tried to understand Sarah as best I could, but Sarah's not even her real name. So like, how much can you understand, you know what I mean, about a person when you don't really have their side of the story?
Yeah. Well, it's hard because we don't know how she felt about any of this, you know? Yeah. So it's a person who people have really strong emotions about what happened to her. So her story has ended up becoming, I feel like, an amalgamation of so many people's really intense feelings.
Yes.
And feelings that are based around a lot of stuff that we've only been talking about for, what, like 10 years?
Yeah.
You know, like, if that, like, this is all, like, very new dialogue. So, yeah, I just think we have to try and be open and gentle and learn what we can and try and do the best that we can.
Do justice for Sarah and what happened to her.
Yeah.
So, like I just said, her name is unknown, although some believe that the closest that we've come up with is Sihura, and that's if, like, the Dutch then translated it to their version of Sarah, which was then translated to the English version, but that's only if that's the case. Mm-hmm. The Dutch called her Sarti, which is a diminutive of Sarah, and this marked her as a colonialist servant in South Africa. Her surname, which literally means, like, Bartman means bearded man in Dutch, also meant uncivilized, uncouth, barbaric, and savage. Mm-hmm. So the name Sarah Bartman pretty much translates to savage servant.
Oh, my God.
Which is a horrible thing to be labeled as you are being, like, presented to a Western European white culture.
Yeah.
Her family is believed to have been farmers outside of the center of the Dutch colony. So before South Africa was a British colony, which it is by the time Sarah dies, she was born into it when it was a Dutch colony. And her family would have been working on a farm for the Dutch colonialists.
Okay.
Her mother died when she was 2 years old, and her father died while driving cattle from one place to another. He was killed. One of the articles said that he was killed by the Bushmen, which was a group of people living in the bush in that region. But that wasn't said everywhere. She seemed to have spent most of her own childhood and teenage years working on said farm. So she was doing a lot of the farm work. In the late 1790s, and remember, she was only said to have been born around 1789, so maybe she's 10 years old, she met Peter Cesare. He was biracial, it said in many articles, and he encouraged her to move to the center of town, to Cape Town, where she lived and worked in his household as a washerwoman and a nursemaid, first for Peter and then for his brother Hendrik.
Okay.
She moved to Hendrik Cesare to be a wet nurse, actually, because there's evidence that she was with a poor Dutch soldier and maybe even married him and birthed two children, but both of the babies had died. Mm-hmm. So she would only be able to be a wet nurse if she had made it to the point of lactation herself. So that's what she's doing in Hendrik's house.
Okay.
But this relationship with the Dutch soldier ended when his regiment left Cape Town, although some said it ended because he was killed. So one of the two. Hendrik began to take her to the city hospital to show her in exchange for cash. This seems to have been medical showings of, like, a black African woman specimen. So it really starts out gross because she's working in his house, and then he's taking this most likely 10 to 15 year old girl to a hospital to have her observed. And this is where we meet surgeon either William Dunlop or Alexander Dunlop. I'm going to call him Alexander because one of the articles said he's often named as William. So I'm just going to say he is a Scottish military doctor named Alexander working in the Cape.
Okay.
Alexander has this side gig where he supplies showmen in Britain with animal specimens. He suggests that she make some more money for herself by traveling to Europe to exhibit herself. She refuses. Hendrik refuses, but Alexander persists, and finally she's like, I will go if Hendrik goes. And at first Hendrik's like, no, you know, I have a family of kids. Obviously she was being a wet nurse for him, so he has children that he's, like, providing for. But eventually Hendrik gets convinced too, and in 1810 they were off to make some money putting Sarah on display in England.
I hate the narrative that always comes up in this story where it's like, you should be so grateful that we're giving you a different opportunity than the only other one we're offering you, where it's either a sideshow character in a circus or a servant in someone's house. Like, I hate that it's like, isn't this better than servant?
It's funny, colonialism, I think that they believed that they were being altruistic.
They definitely did. They're like, I think that guy's like, I'm being kind.
Yes, that is what he thought. This is a nice
thing that I'm doing for you. You should, and like that, and then, and I hate that thing of like, you should be grateful for the scraps that I'm throwing your way,
because it's almost like you should be grateful that I'm allowing you to get paid for this when my animals don't get paid. You know what I mean? It's like, they're like, you should be grateful that I'm treating you a little bit better than an animal, which is just disgusting.
And we see terrible. That mentality even now.
Yeah.
In so many different ways.
We sure do. Okay. So it's unknown whether or not this was forced. She definitely signed a contract to go to England, but she was definitely illiterate.
That was my next question, was she even literate?
She was illiterate. She could speak many languages. She can read many languages. Okay. And often we paint this, that she signed the contract, in a present day lens of like, wow, she was choosing to exhibit her body and make money off of it. But that's a present day view of what was happening. Like, we can say that about modern day sex workers who are making the choice to, you know, dance or perform sex acts for money.
Which, again, I feel this is also a term that is getting very misconstrued now. There is a difference between women who are being trafficked and sex workers.
Correct.
They are being conflated now in a lot of conversations, and I hate it. There are some women who actively choose to do it, and there are some women who are
trafficked into doing it.
Right. And they are not the same.
It's like survival sex work.
Yes, exactly.
Instead of like, this is my job.
Yes.
My professional career.
Yeah.
Yes. It's so, I think we're looking at it with a modern lens sometimes, and that takes away from the terrible things that happened to Sarah.
Yeah. And the absolute lack of opportunity she had
to get out of this situation. She was in a country that was not her own.
Yeah.
Very far away. Like, South Africa is thousands and thousands of miles from England. It's not just easy to up and back out of this contract. So Alexander is the front man. He's the driver of the plan, the surgeon. He even wrote to the head of the Liverpool Museum saying that we have on our way, quote, a female Hottentot, a very singular appearance. Hottentot is obviously now a very derogatory word that we don't use. Her act was marked as Hottentot Venus, like, you know, the goddess Venus. Hottentot is shortened into one word from literally hot and tot, which was a Dutch approximation of the Khoi Khoi language, because they have a lot of staccato clicking sounds.
Interesting.
In their language. And it, so it was a way of like kind of making fun of their indigenous speech. And like, it's just a yucky word that we don't use, but unfortunately it comes up in this story a lot. Mm-hmm. So it's hard not to say it. He also said in this same letter that she would make a fortune when she was showed in London. So we know that she is going to receive money from this. And he also mentioned that she was under contract to be sent back in 2 years. So there is an end date of when she's going back to South Africa. Mm-hmm. So it's 1810. Hendrik, Alexander, and Sarah are living in London on Duke Street, in St. James, which is a very wealthy part of London. The household also possibly had two African boys who were brought there illegally. They began showing her in London in the Egyptian room, which was at the residence of Thomas Hope. Alexander thought, and he was right, that they could make money because Londoners lacked familiarity with the African body and specifically her large buttocks. People saw her as part of the, quote, natural world, and a curiosity about her origin story started. So they would like write this like a little short paragraph that went out to people that she was 22 years old and 4'10", has a good capacity. She loved to cook. She lived on the Cape of New Hope. Her people were rich in cattle. You know, they're like writing the back of a book, like a little blurb about her life. We just don't know how much of it is true because they were just trying to sell an experience. The tradition of freak shows in and of themselves was already well established in Europe at this time. And Sarah is said to have never allowed herself to be exhibited nude, but regardless, she was a subject of bodily interest, both in scientific research and erotic projections. And I read in two places that she was never gave permission to be nude, but then in other places that she was exhibited nude regularly. And all the scientific projections of her are drawn in the nude. So I wonder if, like, during the medical research, was exhibited nude, but then, like, in the public, she wasn't. I'm not 100% sure there. Some started to allege scientifically that she was the missing link between man and beast. So now we're starting to get into that really icky racial science that starts to pop up about this time. London had already banned the slave trade, but not slavery. So her showing was a cause of a scandal. Many protested for her release. It should be said that in 1810, people in London were like, this is slavery. Send her home. But others fought for her, saying that she had every right to make money off of her body, just like, this is a quote, the Irish giants or the dwarfs, like the other people in freak shows. They were like, let Sarah show herself. But also those people were being violated as well. So 1810, this abolitionist and the African Association actually took the matter to court and gave her the liberty to say whether she was being exhibited by her own consent. She had been brought to Britain with people who referred to her as property. So that was illegal. That is slave trade. But they were looking for evidence of coercion. But obviously, like we said, she was illiterate. But also they brought in fluent speakers of her language to translate. And she said she was not under restraint. She was not sexually abused. And she had come to London of her own free will. Now, she can also be saying that because of the power dynamic, right? There's a lot going on. She was questioned for 3 hours. So maybe this is just a little bit of the tidbits that they pulled out of her statement. And also her statement is contradictory with eyewitnesses who are saying she is absolutely being sexually abused. She absolutely is being restrained. The publicity of her court only increased the popularity of the exhibition. She traveled from England to Ireland. She was baptized. And there's also evidence that she was married again at some point. Europe at the time would have described Africa as uncivilized and lacking in religious virtue. And black women were seen as sexually primitive and savage, and partially because of her showing, like her, and there were other black women brought there at the time. And like we said, it was seen as altruistic and that people were doing what was best for the people in Africa and that these men were doing what was right for the empire and for Christianity, which we know is totally hypocritical and not true. Now, even if she did travel to England of her own free will, this appears to have changed when she traveled to France. A man named Henry Taylor took Sarah to Paris in around 1814 and sold her to a man. How do you say the names that are R-E-A-U-X? Roe?
I would think Roe.
Roe. That's what I thought. Okay. He sold her to a man who went under the name S. Roe. He was an animal trainer and had actually been previously deported from the Cape Colony for seditious behavior. Roe spent the next 15 months exhibiting her under more pressured conditions in Paris. Her exhibition became more clearly entangled with scientific racism. He had the head of the Natural History Museum do several paintings of her body and had her examined. In Paris, she even began drinking and smoking heavily. And that's usually a sign that you are trying to, like, forget whatever situation you're in. Sarah was brought out as an exhibit at wealthy parties to private homes and private saloons. Her promoters did not concern themselves with slavery charges. They would let people like poke her and touch her at these private parties.
I was going to say, you know, she's not being treated well at these parties.
No, because but it used to be like she was in a cage in the middle of a room and people would walk around. And now it's like she's in someone's living room where they have the power.
And they're drunk and they are doing whatever they want
and showing off to their friends. Mm-hmm. Yes. They also started showing her with a collar around her neck. We're unsure if it was a prop or not, or it was actually used to lock her up. And many also claim during this time she was trafficked sexually as well. So Sarah dies December 29th, 1815, around 26 years old. The reason is undetermined. Some say it's alcoholism. Some say it was smallpox, syphilis, pneumonia. But she died penniless due to the economic depression in France after the defeat of Napoleon Bonaparte, at which point they, quote, dissected her body, not gave her an autopsy, dissected her body. A French anatomist published notes on her dissection in 1816, and then in 1870, a man who knew her republished the notes. His name was Georges Cuvier, and in his notes, he said these things first. She was an intelligent woman, had an extreme memory, particularly of faces. She spoke her native tongue, but was also fluent in Dutch, English, as well as a smattering of French. He described her shoulders, back, and arms as slender and graceful, and that her feet and hands were charming and pretty, and that she could play the harp and dance and had a lively personality. Despite all of these positive things that this man said, he still interpreted her remains as ape-like. And he said that her small ears were similar to an orangutan and her vivacity was similar to monkeys. He was clearly part of the movement of scientists who sought to identify and study the differences between different human races with the aim to prove racial hierarchy.
What is vivacity?
Like, she was, like, very spunky and, like...
Oh, like, literally her, like, vivaciousness.
Yeah.
Oh.
Made her monkey-esque.
What?
Yeah. I don't know.
Okay. That's
maybe she's
stretch.
Just, like, the life of a party, dude. Yeah. Like, calm down. And, like, okay, I want to be clear. This man, too, is one of the 17 people whose names is on the Eiffel Tower. Hmm. This man is a famous natural historian of France, and he is just a bad, bad guy. Like, it really fucking sucks that this is the type of thing he was doing, amongst other, I'm sure, amazing discoveries. But this is a big black mark on the record. And if this was happening to her, you know it was happening to other people. After her death, the Museum of Natural History in France applied to keep her remains. This is along with Cuvier. And they get approved and they preserve her skeleton. They pickle her brain and genitalia in a jar. They make a plaster cast of her dead body. Her skull is stolen from the Museum of Natural History sometime around 1827, but was returned a few months later. And then there's a new museum. It's like the Museum of Humans. That's what I was translating, although it was in French. And it was founded in 1937. Her body parts were moved there, the skeleton, the cast. They were displayed side by side, facing away from the viewer, so you could ogle her rear. And this is how it went for hundreds of years until 1974. So, like, they started showing her in 1827. It's not until 1974 when the museum, this is second wave feminism, starts getting complaints that the display is a degrading representation of women. Like, you can't do that. So the skeleton was removed in 1974 and the cast of her body in 1976. Starting as early as the 1940s, though, there were sporadic calls for her to be returned to South Africa. There was a poem in 1998 that said, "I've come to take you home," by Diana Ferris. As history chugged along, there was more and more. Stephen J. Gould was an American paleontologist who asked to bring her back to South Africa. A man named Manswell Upham was a researcher of South African history who asked to bring her home. And in 1994, after apartheid ended, even Nelson Mandela, newly elected, requested France to send Sarah's remains back to South Africa so she could have a proper burial in her home country. More on that later. We'll see if it happens. First, we should know that Sarah was not the only Khoi Khoi woman taken from her homeland. She was one of many. She's often used as a symbol against colonialization, against the exploitation of the female body, against the power of the patriarchal lens. But because of that, her story is lost. This is kind of what you and I said at the top. People tell her story and they base her in being a symbol instead of a real woman. Mm-hmm. The men in her story were not unique. Many people, including P.T. Barnum, took Khoi Khoi people, and he exhibited them also as the missing link. I think her story became so famous because Europeans were obsessed with the female form and her body, and having her genitalia on display for 150 years was like a way to like sate that like stodgy like Western European thing. And I think it's a shame because this comparison is like a summary of what people think of the black female form throughout history in comparison with the Euro white female form. Mm-hmm. And it is commonly believed that Sarah's body type was actually not that crazy. In fact, people believed, based on what anthropologists have found in African art, that her body type was much more common in the past mm-hmm. than it was now. And as much as we look and say, wow, we know better, when debating whether or not to send her remains home, the curator of the same museum in Today Times, Philippe Mencier, or Felipe probably, Mencier, said, "We never know what science will be able to tell us in the future. If she's buried, this chance will be lost. For us, she remains a very important treasure." Like, you're going to find she's not human or something.
Exactly. They're still operating under that mindset.
Right. Like, what are you going to fucking find out, dude? She had a different body type.
Literally. Like, that's what's so frustrating.
Same ideology.
Like, it's the same ideology of, mm-hmm. like, whoever this guy is, like, still thinks that she's the missing link.
Right.
And it's like, she's not. She was just a fucking woman.
She's a person that you, like, sold. Ugh. Feminists also have several different takes on this. Some argue that you should have pride in your body and let's reclaim the story for empowerment against mainstream beauty and an encouraging look at black feminine figures, which I agree with. Others argue that we gotta never exploit women for the male gaze, which I agree with. There's arguments that say that she could display herself on her own terms if she wanted, which I agree with. Like, I agree with everybody's point of view, but we don't know what Sarah thought or how Sarah felt. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sad. And then a few years back, do you remember that photo shoot where Kim Kardashian was on the front of the magazine and she had like a champagne glass like balanced on her ass and like the champagne going over her head? Mm-hmm. People got really up in arms and pissy about that because they felt like she was using this, like, specifically pictures of Sarah where she's kind of drawn like that to like bring attention to her own self and like promote this image of like other than whiteness sexuality. And it's like, I sort of defend Kim Kardashian on this one. Like, she has a very curvy body mm-hmm. and is not a white woman. Like, mm-hmm. she's Armenian. Like, mm-hmm. Whatever. But I just, that was something that really came up in recent years that people were pissed about. Now, if I don't know the whole story on that and like who came up with the photo shoot, mm-hmm. if it's like a super racist person mm-hmm. who's making the image, that's yeah. very different
yeah.
than like Kim promoting her own brand. Mm-hmm. Social scientists also brought her up in relation to the Williams sisters. There's a Bartman effect there. White male sports reporters fixate especially on Serena's body type because she is curvy. They are hyper focused on their fashion. Mm-hmm. They're hyper focused on the fact that they are naturally good at this sport because of their blackness. Like, it's very gross. Instead of being like, wow, no, they trained really hard.
Yeah.
And it's entirely derogatory.
Yes. Well, and it's, again, it's that mindset of like, how can we count the ways that like we're going to connect them to animals because we're still not seeing them as human.
Right.
And they are.
Right.
Like
what?
And it's so incredibly frustrating. I mean, we talked about that with Babe Diedrichsen last mm-hmm. week about how like
you know, people are like, well, you're just too manly for our comfort.
So clearly you're a man.
Clearly you're a man. So like clearly like you shouldn't be participating with these other like gentle ladies.
And this happened in the last Olympics.
Yeah.
The most recent Olympics.
This is happening.
Right.
And it's interesting, too, because I wonder, because like we talked about her. We use the term vivaciousness. And I also yeah. feel like that's a part of it, of like the Williams sisters are not like silent on the court.
They're not
and
dainty.
That also upset people, of like that they like actually made noise. It's like, yeah, because they're really working their asses off on the court.
Right. Like if a man made a noise playing sports, nobody would be like, bah.
Yeah. Wow. Must be related to an animal. Like it's so frustrating and it's so based in racism.
Yeah.
And it's so frustrating.
It's racism and like layered with misogyny. Yeah. Like it's just really terrible. Mm-hmm. So after almost a decade, Nelson Mandela's request, you know, there was a lot of mumbo jumbo and legal bullshit that went on in France after Nelson was like, please bring them home, or President Mandela. She was finally sent home to rest in 2002 and buried on a hill near the town of her birth. It was nearly 200 years after she was born there.
Oh my gosh.
Sarah has become the landscape upon which multiple narratives of exploitation and suffering within Black womanhood have been enacted. And I think that, unfortunately, the woman in this story is still pretty invisible.
Yeah.
Like, we don't know a lot about Sarah, and we probably never will, because it wasn't recorded, really. She was just living with these two dudes that were, like, trying to make money off of her. So, that's the, like, really sad and brief history of Sarah Bartman.
Wow. Well, I think we need to talk about these two women together in conversation in a little segment we like to call Just the Two of Us. I mean, this was a very apt comparison, and we didn't plan this, because I think at the core of it, it's what happens when you fictionalize sexual harassment and a woman being valued for her body and her vivaciousness versus like what it looks like in reality on a non-white body,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah, and I think that's exactly the point, right? Like mm-hmm. that Daisy Duke is the traditional beauty stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
And Sarah Bartman is a non-white body. She yeah. is a non-white human that people are exploiting, you know, for themselves. And meanwhile, like, it seemed like Catherine mm-hmm. Buckman had a lot of choice in what she wore and how
she
played the character.
She literally designed the costume.
Right.
You know?
So and it seems like she had more power behind what she could do.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, and like in the show, it kind of seemed like, yeah, like sexual harassment is like not okay. But like, isn't it great when a girl can like fight back? And it's also like, yeah, but the actual reality of that is that it doesn't happen very often.
Yeah. And if you do fight back, they're like, why are you so upset?
Exactly.
Like, why are you fucking mad at
you
me?
You should be grateful for being here,
right.
you know, and which also is like,
it's, or like that I even looked at you, you fucking bitch.
Exactly.
You know how many times people will be like, you're so ugly. You're lucky I even touched you.
100%.
Shut the fuck up.
Like, the harassment by drunk people is like common in both of their stories.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating because they're also surrounded by people who are invested in them as a commodity, but not they don't have your best interest in mind. Like, Daisy is employed by the family's enemy,
mm-hmm.
and he employed her because she is attractive and he knows that men will come at the bar to harass her.
Mm-hmm.
and it sucks because it's tied up in other men's money, both of their employment. It's like she has to work there because they got a loan for a certain percentage.
Right.
And Sarah is tied in with these guys' money because they're making money off of her body. Like, it's interesting because I didn't know that part about Daisy Duke's story because I didn't grow up watching the show,
mm-hmm.
you know? So I didn't know that, like, her employment is tied up in other people's money and other people's well-being.
And it's hard to get out of a contract like that when you have to support yourself.
Yeah. And it's like, we know that Daisy had other dreams. Like, she ends up getting a friggin' PhD from Duke University, you know? And
right.
It's like, maybe Sarah wanted to do things like that too, but we don't know because their options were stripped by other people's behavior and other people's expectations of their behavior and their loyalty. And yeah, I don't know, like
I think too that I found it interesting that at the beginning of both their stories, both their parents died, mm-hmm. and they were working on farms, working and living on farms.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, this is what it looks like when your parents die and you are working and living on a colonialist farm versus your parents die and you're an ancestor of a colonialist, mm-hmm. right? Like you are part, like you're working on your uncle's farm. You are part of the land takers. Like it, the vibe is totally different.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's also interesting because they're also like pieced apart physically. Like I was thinking about how like her legs were insured, and it's like, you know, we talk about it, it's like, oh, that's so funny, and like it makes sense because like obviously that is like a big part of the show, and like she's making money off of her legs. But then like when you really do think about it, you're like, that is kind of gross. And then Sarah's body was literally dissected and sold to various others. So she's like, she's still being exploited and pieced apart. And
after being fetishized for like her whole existence.
Yeah, exactly. And then we take both of these women into modern times. And it's so funny that like Sarah's modern reckoning came during the time of Dukes of Hazzard. Like that's so interesting to me, is that like, we're just now catching up to like maybe what happened to Sarah wasn't okay. And we didn't quite catch up to like how Dukes of Hazzard maybe was not okay until 2015 was when it stopped airing. And obviously, again, conversations were happening before that. But, you know, it's like, and I don't want to discourage people from entering into these conversations because like, yes, like they seem late now, but they did happen, which I also think is important. You know, like anybody who makes a Dukes of Hazzard remake now does not put the Confederate flag on top of the car. Maybe it's in other places, but it's not on top of the main character of the freaking show, you know?
Right.
And Sarah is now home to rest and her body is not being portrayed anywhere, but we still have the images.
Right.
You know, and it's like, we still have to live with the decision that people made. And we have to keep having these conversations to be like, yeah, like, let's not do that again.
Well, we're in that really like the era of reckoning. Mm-hmm. And I see it more and more because like, obviously, we've talked a lot about this recently, how social media is targeted. Mm-hmm. And one thing I've seen a lot of is like, oh, liberals are always so mad. They're so mad about everything. And it's like, I'm not mad about everything. I'm actually like a very happy, go lucky, mm-hmm. like person who enjoys my life and other people. But I am willing to look at something and say, that is wrong. It was wrong then, and we should not let it continue.
Right.
Like, let's stop with that. And it's not that there aren't Republicans that do that as well. Mm-hmm. I just think, like, the idea is that liberals and feminists are, like, these stodgy, like, get offended by everything people. And it's, no, we're making you answer for your bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been too long.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, like, reckon with what you've done.
Yeah. Well, and I also think that the way that social media works and the way that rage bait works is that like the squeakiest wheels get all the grease. The craziest people on both sides get all of the attention because there are some accounts that are literally made to like make you fucking angry.
Oh yeah.
You know, we do have to like step in, like you have to start looking at things with like a realistic eye of like, did this person actually cut the bottoms of all their shoes so they could walk barefoot in public? Or are they trying to make people mad so that more people comment so that they make more money? You know what I'm saying? It's like, and again, then there are plenty of people who don't make any money off of it. They just love to rile people up or say the craziest thing. And I just like, I want people to have real conversations about this. And because what happens is that like, then like people feel attacked, so they don't want to have any conversations.
Right.
And I think that that's a real detriment to like things moving forward as a society of like,
I agree. I think that's a great point. Like, it's good to sit down and talk with the people you care about, especially when they disagree with you. Yeah. Like, I do it with producer all the time. We have very different political views. Mm-hmm. I would say the person I probably do it with the most, who I never change their mind, is my dad. Mm. We have political conversations all the time, and we are definitely opposite ends of the spectrum. But I think both of us always walk away from it feeling better, just understanding why the other person feels that way, instead of just assuming why they feel that way.
Yes. Yeah. Ugh. Well, this got
real deep, into a lot real of dark. I'm so sorry.
This was supposed to be like a light spring break episode.
I really tried. I really didn't know. I'm sorry, everyone.
All right. Well, who would you like to toast this evening?
So one thing that I do, I would say maybe once a week or once every other week in my classroom at school when I'm teaching history, is I just make all the kids stop. And we say, like, this was a real person. The people we're reading about had a family and a job and emotions and heartbreak. And, like, let's, like, take 3 seconds and just remember that the people we're talking about were actual real people. Yeah. And I think that's what Sarah's story needs, instead of making her a constant cause.
Yeah.
She was a real person who died at 26 years old, being taken from her home and treated like a circus animal and like a scientific experiment. And it's terrible. So, like, I guess my toast is, like, to just put the humanity back in our people we use as symbols.
Cheers.
Cheers.
I'm going to toast the good girls who know when to be bad.
Yeah.
I do love that, like, she's always portrayed as, like, being very kind, but also, again, fiercely loyal, and we'll get into some shenanigans.
She's sassy. So.
Cheers.
Cheers.
All right. Now, what are you enjoying in pop culture this week?
Okay. So I want to do an update real quick on the last one I did. Sunrise on the Reaping, the Haymitch book. It was very good. So go ahead and read it. Everybody good. Read it. But I want to promote Walking Off the Beaten Path. It's something that producer and I always do when we're traveling. Like, we don't go to chain restaurants. We, like, try to find a place that kind of looks like, oh my God, what is that stupid barbecue place right near your house? That's yellow.
Big Bad Wolf.
Yeah. We try to go to places that look like kind of like a hole in the wall, like with their menu is like stained because it's been on, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I just, like, I encourage people to do that, especially, like, if you feel safe traveling in big cities. Like, I know some people don't because they're not used to living in cities, but find a local establishment and, like, that's a little bit outside the city limits and just, like, experience what it's like to be with, like, other people who are just trying to make it day to day.
Yeah.
It's so fun.
One of my favorite things I learned recently is that, like, a lot of people in, like, I think it was, like, a small Irish town were sick of tourists populating their, like, local watering holes. So they started, like, really pumping up. Like, the locals were writing really positive reviews about this horrible restaurant. And so they've been, like, funneling all the tourists there. And this is a, and, like, and I say that to be, like, the online reviews cannot always be trusted.
Yeah.
And you know immediately, like, that happened to us in New Orleans, like, one of the first restaurants we went to, and I was like, a tourist trap.
Yeah.
I was like, damn it. But, and that's what you're saying, is, like,
just walk around.
Walk around. And if you see a spot, you're like, that looks cool, and, you know, you need to make a reservation for later on in the trip.
And come back.
Because you can come back, you know? And I just, like, walking around and finding a place is such a great way to do it. And I know it's, like, very stressful sometimes for people, but
yeah,
it's so worthwhile.
And it's a good way to get to, like, know a city and community. Yes. Like, and I mean, it does, you do have to be comfortable traveling. It's very hard for people, especially in, like, a foreign language city. Like, I know, like, in Paris, it's going to be harder than it was in London.
Yeah.
And like, in San Antonio, like, fortunately, I speak enough Spanish, and so do, like, most of the people in our family. But like, you could have been really uncomfortable doing that in San Antonio if you don't speak a lot of Spanish, because 60% of the population of San Antonio speaks fluent Spanish.
Yeah.
But they also speak English. Like, so it's not like you have to just try. Most people are just great and nice. Yeah. So I'm just promoting, just, like, don't just go to the first place that's like neon colors and like fun signs that say margaritas.
Yeah, 100%.
Find somewhere else.
Very true. I'm going to recommend a book that I just finished. It is the book Dinner for Vampires by Bethany Joy Lenz. Uh-huh. Have you read this?
No.
So she was famous for being on the show One Tree Hill. Mm-hmm. And so she wrote a book because she was like, well, the whole time I was on this cult TV show, I was in an actual cult. And it is her experience. And it is so crazy because like the whole book sucks you in like the cult does, you know, because you're like, well, this isn't too bad. It's just like a Bible study, you know? And then you're like, oh, he is slowly taking control over her life and her mind. And it is just wild.
Yikes.
And she makes a point at the end of the book where she's like, I understand that like this, it's a very small cult, but it was very real and they did a lot of terrible things to me. But she was like, it's not as flashy as other things. So sometimes she's like, I'm embarrassed that like I say like I was in a cult and people are like, which one? Like Children of God, were you in Nexium? Were you in this? Were you in that? And she's like, well, no, it was like really more of a homegrown cult. but it was like such a fascinating story. And like it, like she just does such a good job of like sucking you in as she was getting sucked in, you know? And it's just, and then combating that with her time being like a really famous person on one of the biggest TV shows in the early 2000s. So yeah, it was so good. Very well written. I loved it. So yeah.
Perfect.
Dinner for Vampires. All right. Well, thank you all so much for listening. We hope you have a wonderful spring holiday and we can't wait to see you next week for another episode. And in the meantime, you can rate and review us. You can join us on Patreon where we have fun conversations. But yeah, if you don't want to do any of that, just keep listening to the show. We love to have you. And we want you to never forget that well-behaved women
don't wear whatever the fuck they want.
No, and they rarely make history.
Goodbye. You've been listening to Her Story on the Rocks. We are independently produced by 1986 Entertainment and proudly recorded in Baltimore, Maryland. If there's a woman in history you would like us to cover, you can email us at herstoryontherocks@gmail.com. You can also message us on Twitter or Instagram. We post all of our cocktail recipes on Tuesdays so that you can go get all the supplies you need and drink along with us. See you next week. Bye.